welcome to another episode of the Scouting Australia podcast, powered by Australian Property Scout Buyers Agency. I'm your host, Sammy Gordon. I'm joined, as always, by my good mate, Jimmy Ibrahim. How are you, big fella? Good to have you back. Hey,
I'm very good, and what better day to do the podcast than the big dog? It's his birthday, mate. Happy birthday. I know you wanted to keep it under the radar, but we've definitely got to make a bit of noise about it. The big dog, the bull shark.
The bull shark, as you
21, how does it feel?
Well, I wish. It's good, mate. As you know full well, being a couple of decades in front of me, bud. Mate, it's just your birthday is just another number as it ticks around, mate. I'm feeling good. Everything's going well, mate. It's a good day already so far, man. So thanks for the birthday,
mate, wishes, buddy. I know your head has literally taken up my whole screen, and it's bigger than it normally is. But mate, I'm starting to see a few grays there as the years tick on. Look at you,
mate. I'm definitely catching up. You're a good few thousand in front of me, mate. But I'm hot on your heels, and in a couple of decades now, I'll catch you.
The grey bull shark is upon us, ladies and gentlemen.
Guys, it's great to have you back. It's great to be back here and recording another episode for you guys. The reviews are coming in thick and fast. We really appreciate it. Last week's Q&A went off. We've got more questions coming in off the back of it. So obviously we really, really appreciate you guys sending that in. The questions are coming in, they're quality, and it allows us to deliver some good value back to you guys. So I'd like to say thank you once again, and please make sure you keep sending those in, as well as the reviews as well, guys. We're getting some great response on that. So it's awesome to see those 5-star ratings and testimonials and whatnot come through, guys. Really appreciating it. Today, we've got something a little bit different for you guys. Well, not so much different, just going back to a standard sort of topic. But it's something that we get asked it a lot, and it was sent through so many times as a question for a Q&A that we decided to record this as a full-length episode. The real question and the big thing here is primary residence, PPOR versus rent vesting, and kind of tackling that and breaking down the pros and cons to both sides of it, and what you should really be doing. I know Jimmy, as most of you guys know, he runs our discovery calls here at Australian Property Scout these days. I ran them obviously for all the years previous, but he's been recording for a long time now too, taking them for a long time now too. And it's such a prevalent question that I reckon one in three, four, five people ask us, should we be going down that route and potentially buying the prime residence now, or should we be rent vesting instead? Jimmy, mate, what are your thoughts on this?
Mate, this would have to be one of the absolute cracking questions, because this, and rightfully so, because when you think about it, normally we get a lot of calls from people in their 20s, even in their 30s, if they might not have got into the property market. The biggest question is, what do I do? And do you go down the primary place of residence, or do you go into the rent vesting? And let's face it, a lot of the government schemes with the First Home Buyers Grant, they are going to try and sway you to want to get into the market. So I think the first thing I wanted to bring up with you is just to understand the difference in the strategies, right? Mm. Because when we're looking at buying your own primary place of residence, and a lot of our, and I'm going to say first-time investors,
yep,
they're trying to capitalize on the First Home Buyers Grant from the government. Fair to say?
Yeah.
So it's definitely a different strategy in that sense compared to if you're going to go down the investing road, you're saying, you know what? I don't need the government incentive. I'm not looking for the First Home Buyers Grant. I'm just wanting to get started. So it's important to understand the key differences.
Yeah.
So a lot of people are spruiking both ends.
Yeah.
First of all, for you, the government who is trying to get you into the First Home Buyers Grant, they don't want you, they're not marketing that to the investor, correct?
Correct. Jimmy, mate, I'm surprised at the quality of the first thing that you've brought to the table here, being obviously the government grants, because it's a big one that comes up. So, mate, well done.
Mate, it's your birthday. Thought I'd just hit you with a nice little. I know you like a bit of cheesecake, a bit of baklava.
That's my first present, my first sweet for the day. Man, I think the first homeowner grants, they're a funny one, and it's an interesting one to dissect, because, and also, as you know, quite openly, is I started with the First Home Owner Grant. And if I didn't have access to the First Home Owner Grant, it might have taken me another 12, potentially 24 months, probably another 12 months to save enough of a deposit to be able to buy something. So there's something to really consider when you're thinking about getting into the market. The one thing to really look at, though, and a lot of things have changed around First Home Owner Grants as well. I remember back in the day, especially when I bought mine, first time owner grants, majority of the time we're geared towards existing property. So, you know, you weren't having to go out there and either buy an existing, buy a new apartment or buy land and build and go down that route, which if anything, especially for a first timer, is quite fraught with danger of making a mistake in that regard. But for me, it was a massive leg up, man. I'd only saved into the low 20s, 20,000s. As a 10% deposit on what I needed. My first property was 275,000. So I would have needed 27.5 grand deposit plus stamp duty and all the rest of it. My grant at the time was 10.5 grand plus no stamp duty. So it was a massive leg up for me to get into the market. But I also didn't know any better. And I was located in Sydney, which at the time, this was in 2009. So at the time in Sydney, like it wasn't a bad time to be getting into the market. It was still a few years out from when Sydney really took off in 2013, 2014. But it really helped me get into the door of that property and begin my journey, right? And if I didn't have it, like I said, it would have taken me a bit longer. The one thing to note, that really important factor of what I brought up before is like right now, you can't get that same grant. Even on existing property, and I think, guys, I don't know the full ins and outs of the rules because it's state by state now. So it is they change all the time. They're very different. But almost all states now, they have nothing to do with existing property. Even if you want a stamp duty exemption, a lot of the time the stamp duty exemption only comes in on brand new purchases. And then there's, you know, some states give you the stamp duty exemption and a bit of a grant. It could be, you know, 5, 10, 20 grand on top of that, depending on the state. What you have to look at, though, is, and if you're buying new, especially if you're buying a house and land or if you're buying an apartment, are you actually making any money on that deal? Is it going to be in the right market? Is it going to be oversupplied with investors, you know, or potentially first-time buyers, other first-time buyers that are kind of getting into that market? Like, what's really going to be driving the growth in that area or at that price point? I think it's a really important thing to note and kind of take into the equation. So grants, man, they're a good one to look at. And so what I would do first and foremost, if you were trying to weigh the two up, is you would have a good look at the market you were looking to get into. And let's say you were in a market that you were quite convinced, or you hear different people talking about that has potential for strong growth, it might be a location worth looking at taking advantage of the grants if they also work in line with it being a decent investment decision. If they're not, which 99 times out of 100 they're not, I would pass on the grants and build the portfolio first, because you're going to be able to come back to actually buy something you want, not just something you can just afford just to take advantage of a grant, which you might get stamp duty exemption and 10 grand if you're paying some sort of, you know, commission, some built-in commission there on like a house and land or apartment. There might be a 40 grand commission built in, and you might be 20 in front, but because you're 40 behind, you're literally coming out 20 behind, if that makes sense, those maths. So it's like, it's a very, very murky waters when you go into that brand new sort of product, and something I would be very, very wary of. So I wouldn't be investing purely based, I wouldn't be buying and making that decision purely based off the grants on offer.
Well, the big thing I find, and it's very important, looking at your situation, right? So you obviously were near, you're in the Sutherland Shire, and you bought your first apartment in Wollongong, right? So let's face it, you're going to be buying, if you're looking to use the first time buyer's grant, you're going to have to buy a place that you are going to have to live in, which by the law, right, theoretically. So you're going to be buying where you live. So that's the first thing. Is the area where you're living really a good investment? So for me, I'm in Melbourne, right? So even if I was looking to starting out, would I buy an apartment or whatever it was to comply with the first time buyer's grant just for the grant, even though it might mean that I'm actually getting a worth the kind of property? So you got to ask yourself, why would you do that? So from my thing for you, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but the affordability index back then was a lot more achievable than what it is now. So let's look at people that are in Sydney, because I speak to a lot of people from Sydney. And they're trying to weigh it up. They're like, oh, well, I can get an apartment. I'm like, okay, well, let's look at what kind of property realistically you're going to buy. You're going to buy an apartment because they don't have a huge deposit. You're going to get the first-time buyer's grant, but inevitably you're buying an apartment. And let's just say you're buying it off the plan. For everyone out there, we know that we don't like off the plan because you're buying end-of-the-line product. It's going to stuff up your cash flow because of strata fees. You can't uplift any value. You're buying something over, right? Yes. You're paying over. So is that 10 grand or 15 grand, or even let's just say it was 50 grand. There's no use getting 50 grand discount on a property that's doing nothing over the next 5 years.
The other big thing to note as well, Jimmy, is a lot of people actually run into a really big issue with this is, let's say a market like Sydney or Melbourne, you buy something off the plan, you might not settle it for 2 or 3 years if it's that far off, right? Just to get your grants locked in because you sign a contract. if the market slides back 10%, you may have to pull out of that contract and forfeit your deposit. And I saw that happen heaps in 2018, 2019, even going into 2020 in Sydney. A lot of people bought at the tail end of the boom, 2016, 2017, with long off the plan contracts. By the time they came to settle, they were $50,000, $100,000 shortfall on the valuation, which they didn't have the money to come up with. And even if they did, they were literally like, they were going to be settling behind. It was more financially smart and feasible for them to walk away from their deposit they put down. Some of these are like 5, 10% deposits on a $5, $7, $800,000 investment property, and they had to walk away from it. So it's scary, you know, the mistakes that can be made in this regard. So, man, let's just you know, hit the nail on the head with this one. Like, unless it's definitely going to be a smart investment decision, I'll be avoiding off the plan, even you know, as a first home buyer anyway.
What about a question for you then, right?
Yeah.
So the question some people would be saying is, I'm going to buy it as my primary place of residence, but then I want it to be an investment.
Terrible.
That's because you're basically trying to
never cross the two. Never cross it.
Never cross swords.
Never cross swords. You've had a lot of experience with crossing swords. Take it from the man himself. Never cross swords. It never ends well, right, Jimmy? Guys, yeah. So, look, don't be naive. A lot of people make that mistake. I'm going to buy a holiday home, but it's going to be a great investment. I'm going to buy a primary residence and then in 12 months turn into an investment. Like, unless it legitimately is in a fantastic location, which a lot of the time, and when I say location, I mean growth location, not just near the beach or in the city or something like that. Unless it stacks up as an investment, don't be naive in this regard, because it will come back to bite you in the ass like it does with 99% of people that make that decision. Be smart with this stuff and focus on when you're investing, when you're buying a primary residence or a holiday home, whatever it is, when you're going down those avenues, focus on those individual things. Do not cross swords, as Jimmy would have referred to it.
And just to further clarify for people that a little bit on the fence with that, and again, just going back to your primary place of residence, there's a lot of emotion in that because you're living in it. If you're using an investment, it's purely on the numbers. Okay. So when we're looking at the next part of this, about what is the best wealth strategy then?
Yeah.
All right. So a lot of people are saying, well, how do I get ahead? So one path, which one is stronger? Because on one hand, you might be getting the capital gains exemption because it's your primary place of residence, but the other one is your ability to buy more deals. So can you run us through that? Which one would be the best to accumulate wealth?
So this is where it comes back to, as I kind of just alluded to a second ago, it always comes back to the location, right? Like if the location, and some people get this a little bit wrong, right? They think, oh, well, it's grown really well for the last 4 or 5 years. Like it's almost doubled, right? Like it's a great growth location. If anything, that's a reason to avoid it and to be very, very careful buying your primary residence there, because it's something doubles in 5 years. It's very, very unlikely, almost never would double again, especially in the next 5 years or whatnot. It's almost a better market to sit and wait out in that regard. It always comes down to the location. So if like, let's say it was Sydney in the early 2000s, right? Early 20-teens or whatever, very low point in the cycle. Market hasn't done a run in 10 years. You know, it's almost cheaper to buy than it is to own than it is to rent. That market made sense to potentially buy a primary residence in, because if that market's going to grow and your property's going to have a significant growth in the next few years, that in my opinion is the only time that it ever really makes sense to buy a primary residence. If your market's pretty cooked, or if it's significantly cheaper to rent than to own in a certain area, even if the rentals are, you think that they're expensive and vacancies are tight and whatnot, if that factor is massively out of balance, like most markets are right now, because most of the country is going through severe yield compression. And what that means is there's been so much growth, and even though we've had good rental growth, there's been so much price growth that yield compression, which means your rental return against the actual property value, has come back so much. So it's so much cheaper at the moment to rent than it is to live in most good primary residence markets across Australia at the moment. So what I'm getting at with that is, like, it's because it's so much cheaper to rent than it is to own, a much better strategy is to build out an investment portfolio first, rent where you want to live, where it's significantly cheaper to rent than it is to own, and then build the portfolio outside of that. Obviously, that caveat is, like, if the market's, you know, going through, you think is in an early stages of a run and going to have a good run, and potentially you can force some value on something and have that primary residence exemption, actually can be a half-decent strategy from that end. But again, guys, 9 times out of 10, you're better off keeping them separate, build your portfolio separately, and go from there.
Now, obviously, your primary place of residence is an emotional purchase. So there are some people out there, couples, they're about to start their own family. They're looking at having kids, or they might have some kids. And it's only normal to have the nester, you know, usually out of the couple. There's one that wants the nest.
Yes.
So they're seeing more security in having the primary place of residence. What would you say to those people? Because security is a very interesting term when you're looking at this. And what does that actually mean? So for couples out there that have got a young family or are starting a young family, is it still worthwhile to rent vest as opposed to feather the nest with a primary place of residence in terms of what is more secure?
Security, it is, like you said, man, it's a different one to kind of weigh into the equation. Because a primary residence, it's an emotional decision and it's an emotional purchase, right? You have to think about what's really the most important thing to you. If security is the most important thing and you don't want to build a portfolio or whatever, you know, that is what it is. But if you buy a primary residence and it's going to knock you out from the investing game, you have to be realistic with that. I've had a lot of people that are like, they come to that realization and they're like, you know what? We'll rent for another 12 months. We'll put it off for 12 months. We'll invest. We'll buy 1, 2, 3 properties. And in 12 months, we'll buy our primary residence. But we'll build out the foundations of the portfolio first. So then we've got that ticking over in the background. Buy a primary residence, get settled in, you know, let you know, just get the feel for it after 12, 20, 40 months, whatever, and then we might go into it again. But they've laid the foundations early. So even if they tapped out for 5 years, because this is what sometimes can happen, right? You kind of get into this, you know, the swing of things. You buy your primary residence. This is something we'll dive into a second. The banks look at it as a liability, not an asset. So your borrowing capacity gets smashed. You know, you might have your kids and whatnot. And 5 years later, you come back. You don't only have that primary residence that may have done nothing growth-wise because it was there as an emotional purchase, right? But if you've had 2, 3 other investments and you've done very well off and you bought them in the right locations, you know, all the good stuff, and they've had a really great run, you come back in 5 years, they might have doubled. You might come back in 5 years and go, oh, shit, all right, sweet. Well, the primary residence did nothing, but one of them doubled. The other one's had 70% worth of growth. You know, even if your captive serviceability, oh, well, the one that's doubled, let's sell that, reinvest those profits into 2 or 3 more deals, and let's start this journey going again. And so I think it's like a really good, like, safeguard way of building, still building a portfolio and building that wealth. So, like, I understand what you're saying with that security side of things. This is where you have to weigh it up. Everything in life, man, you are one to always say this to me. It's like there's always a give and take. There's always, you know, if you want something in the universe, you've got to give something, you know, as well back to the universe sort of thing. So when it comes to primary residence for me, a lot of the time it's almost another one of those delayed gratification moments where it's like, I would love the security and I would love the status of being able to own my own home, but I'm going to delay it for 12 months. I'm going to delay it for 24 months and I'm going to build out a 2, 3, 4 property portfolio in that time frame. Then I'm going to take a breather and buy the primary residence and we'll come back when we come back. But I'm going to have built this thing out so it's ticking over and doing its thing in the background when I make that decision. And I think that's a big one and a lot of people have done really well off it. I know a lot of our clients have made that decision, gone down that route and really obviously thanked us for the advice and the strategy around that as well.
You know, it's interesting and I'm glad you brought it up because I find the whole concept of security a really interesting one. I know we've touched on this on other potties, right? Because some people think security is having your own home, right? But I always and for everyone listening out there, there's no judgment on what you want to do because as a family and as a couple, and you do whatever you feel is the best for your family, right? So we're not telling you should do this or you should do that. We're just weighing up the two options. Yeah. But I always find it really interesting about security, right? Because let's face it, our golden handcuff, security. And then the reason why I'm saying that is that, yes, you might go out and buy your primary place of residence, right? And it might tap you out of the market. So you feel secure that you're not getting kicked out of your house. You can still stay there and all that. But if the property's not increasing in value, at the end of the day, I don't care what anyone says. Everyone wants a better life. They want to have more means to do whatever they want. So if that decision, even though you're in your own house, but it's not getting you better financially, is that more secure? I don't think it is.
I don't think it is either, man. It's a great point as well because, like, there's the reason the banks don't look at your primary residence as an asset, right? They look at it as a liability because, like, the main reason for that is because you're not deriving an income from it. So But if you touch on that exactly like you said, if it's stalling you with wealth creation, and let's say it stalls you for 5 or 10 years and you don't have anything else ticking over in the background like we spoke about before, you're literally going to get 5 or 10 years down the track. And if you just spin spinning wheels, just surviving and just not even just surviving, maybe just living and enjoying life, whatever, for 10 years in that home, but then you get to that 10-year window and you're like, oh, shit, all right, well, maybe we'll start an investment journey. But now I'm 45 or now I'm 50 or even now I'm 35, whatever, like at whatever point in life you're at. The compounding effect, and we're literally going to run a potty on this soon because I need to break down so people fully understand the compounding effect of making these decisions now and today, and the compounding effect of what I said before, buying could be just literally one property in the right area, or you buy 2, 3, 4 properties. What that will do for you in a 5, 10-year window, it will completely change your life. Even if you buy the primary residence in that 12, 24-month window, if you lay those foundations now and you buy in those, like we always say, man, right property at the right price in the right market, and you put those in the portfolio now, guarantee you in a 5, 10-year window, you're going to have so much money sitting in those deals, you potentially could even just sell them off and pay out the primary residence, or you keep building on that portfolio and really be able to build yourselves a life there as well. So I think it's a massive thing to weigh into the equation. Actually, something that I haven't spoken about heaps before is like this scenario happening to me. I never wanted to rent anywhere, right? When I was young, I was always like, I'll never rent anywhere. I'll only ever own my own home. I thought it was weird. I thought it was for the poor and for the weak, and like who would want to rent somewhere, right?
Well, rent money is dead money is one of the classic sayings, right? Ever.
100%. My parents definitely like reinforced that to me. You know, they said it to me like when I was younger. And it's funny when you think about it, but like when we go back to the velocity of money, if all your debt is tied up in your primary residence and all your capital is tied up in your primary residence, it's not, if anything, like you're constricting yourself in terms of what you can grow, because when you are able to leverage, and that's a beautiful part of leveraging and compounding your growth when you're out there investing, that it can take you so much further. And I look at the change that happened with me when I went back and when I sold that very first property, the Wollongong unit, funnily enough, when I sold that in 2017, I also made the transition out of where I was living, my primary residence. First time ever, I bought when I was 19 and I moved out of this other home when I was 27. I'd always lived out of home in my own home at that point, right? The serviceability increase, even though I rented my house for, I think it was $600 a week, and I went and rented somewhere else for $660 a week, the serviceability increase, even though I was paying more, the serviceability increase of going and renting for more, 10% more, was crazy within my portfolio. I can't remember the exact number it was, but I'm pretty sure it was another property, you know, in terms of borrowing that I was then able to go out and use to purchase and continue to compound and build the wealth. And it goes back to exactly what I was saying before. Like the banks look at your primary residence and they look at that debt, that non-income producing debt, as a liability, not as an asset. When you flip the switch and go into that scenario, your serviceability will increase. And that was, mate, that was, well, buddy, I'm 33 as of today, right? So that was 6 years ago. I was 27 when I did that. And I look at the shift that's happened in my portfolio in the last 6 years. You know, in 6 years, I've gone from, I was at 6 properties, right? So I stalled at the 7. I had to sell one and I did the transition out of my primary residence. Went from 6. Now I'm at 40 properties at, you know, in 6 years, where the first 7 years I only got to the 6 or 7, right? Like, the transition and that massive swing you can have, and not everyone obviously wants to go that big, you don't have to, but the borrowing capacity that I increased at that time and then going out and buying the right property at the right price in the right market allowed me to then leverage up to this next level and this different point. So it's a really important thing to note. You know, people think exactly what you say, they need to have this security, they need to go buy that primary residence, and the thing is, not like very few people, they spend within like their budget or try and stay under budget. When it comes to primary residence, they're trying to max that thing out to get the nicest house they can so they can show their friends and all the rest of it. My honest advice with this is like, keep your ego in check. Rent something, you know, that's the equivalent of that, and go and invest that money. Put that money to work for you, because then you're going to be able to invest something, afford something even better, heaps better than that, you know, in 5 or 10 years down the track, or potentially sooner, once you've invested.
I think you brought up a really good point, and I know you went over it quite quickly, and I want people to really capture this, because people listening to this, they might be thinking, well, hold on a minute, 600, and I know you've answered it, but $600 a week in rent and $600 a week in your mortgage repayments, they're thinking to themselves, surely the bank sees this as the same, because 600 and 600.
Yeah.
There's a very big difference you mentioned. treating one as an asset and one as a liability. Can you just reiterate that again? Because I think that's really important that they're not exactly the same just because the numbers are the same.
Yeah, definitely. So if your mortgage and your rent were the same figure, like for one, in Australia, they would look at it with tax declarations and all the rest of sort of thing. So you actually can kind of leverage it harder from that side too. But it's just the way that they look at it and the way that it's factored into the bank's algorithms and calculations, it always comes out significantly in front because they look at it as a liability that you can't get out of quickly. It's very hard to sell and get out of your house very quickly. At the fastest, most of the time, it's like it would be a 3-month turnaround. You know, if something, if shit hit the fan and you really struggled, it's most of the time like a 3-month turnaround. Get your house ready. It might take you 2 weeks, put on the market, sell it. It might take another 2-4 weeks and then 6 weeks to settle it. That's if you're not selling at a, you know, you might be selling at a massive discount even just to get out quick. But like banks understand that that process isn't fast. If you run into big issues and again, shit hits the fan and you're on a $600 a week rental, you can tap out of that thing in a week and go rent something for $400 a week or something if you really needed to. And that's why they look at the risk side and the limitations around that. And they know obviously it's not a very liquid asset and hence why they, and it's not bringing in any income. Hence why they're looking at it as a liability and not an asset.
Okay. So I think we've answered the serviceability question then, really. The whole idea of rent vesting is your ability to service more, get into more deals.
Yeah.
So let's just play a scenario then. So we've got someone who buys their primary place of residence, and let's just say in 10 years, they buy for $500,000.
Yeah.
In 10 years' time, they're saying to you, well, my house now is worth $1 million.
Yeah.
Right? How do you look at that from an investing perspective and think, okay, over those 10 years, what realistically, if you were starting out instead of buying a $500,000 primary place residence, and we're saying it doubled in 10 years, if you started out investing, what would be an example of what you could do? And just as a broad, because obviously there's plenty of different factors.
100%. All right. So let's say you get to that point and, you know, you pay off $100,000 of your loan and you know, it doubles and it goes to $1 million, right? You're at $600,000 worth of equity, which is great.
And you're thinking, how good's that?
A lot of people are thinking that. But imagine your serviceability is a lot better. And in that first year, instead of buying one property for $500,000, you buy two. Okay. And then every consecutive year after that, you just buy one property a year. You don't go aggressively. You pull some equity out. You save a bit more. You buy another property a year, right?
What price point are we talking about, roughly?
Let's just say we're talking the same money, right? Let's just say you're talking your $500,000, same equivalent sort of property, because your serviceability is going to be better, so you're going to be able to do it. Even if that first year you just bought those two, in 10 years, man, you're going to be doubling from. Because if let's just say they're the same market, right? All things equal, and you're renting in the same market. You know, whatever, because you're not going to pay that much extra off, right? Let's say you pay off the extra $100,000. But if you bought the two investments that are in the same market, they've grown the same way, they've both gone to $1 million, you're going to have the $1 million in equity as opposed to the $600,000. Even if you hadn't paid anything off, you'd get $1 million instead of the $600,000. But what about everything else you could have bought along that way as well? So even if you just bought one a year every year, obviously the compounding effect of that, if you look at it, if they're all doing, this is, you know, you average it. Let's even just say that none of them performed as well. As an average, they were kind of $250,000 in front per property by the time you get there. If you've got the extra 8 properties, that's another $2 million you are in front, right? So you're 8 by 250 in terms of growth. That's a subpar 10-year growth rate. You're $2 million plus the $2,500 you bought at the start. You're at $3 million net equity in 10 years as opposed to the $600,000 you got on that. Now, how much of a legend, I was going to say another word, but how much of a legend will you feel if in 10 years you sell those, you sell all of them, you pay a little bit of tax, and from the $3 million you're left with $2.5 million? Because obviously you've got to remember as well, you got 50% capital gains tax exemptions. So a lot of people get scared of capital gains tax, right?
Yeah, they don't want to pay it, right? They're like, nah, it's not worth it.
Then it's a part of doing, it's a cost of doing business and it's a cost of profiting. It's like, if you go and make $1 million, you know, in your job, you're going to pay probably around about $400,000 in tax. But if you go make $1 million out of property and you've owned it for over 12 months, you've got a 50% capital gains tax exemption. So you don't pay tax on the first $500,000 and then you pay tax on the remaining amount. So you might pay $200,000 on the $1 million as opposed to the $400,000. So if you're making that sort of numbers and if you sold them in, if you were smart tax effectively and you sold them in consecutive years, you know, you might pay on the $3 million, you might pay, you know, $500,000, $600,000, something like that in the tax as opposed to the other side of it. So, you know, how much further you can get in front like that, just leveraging. And man, that's like that's just taking it easy, you know, just buying one property a year, being conservative, just buying the one property a year, getting an average annual growth rate, not timing markets at the absolute bottom and doubling in 3-4 years, whatever, pulling out, doing that sort of stuff. So I'm literally talking about a very, very basic strategy there. You would literally be probably circa $2 million in front going down that avenue. Now tell me, like, how much of a better property could you buy with that amount of capital, as opposed to the 600 grand, if you're sitting at like 2.5 mil profit cash at the end of it, how much of a better property could you realistically have bought in that time? And you probably could have rented a better property than what you would have bought at the start. So you actually might be have a better living quality, like better quality of life, living in a nicer property for probably similar, you know, similar rent or whatever to what you're going to be paying as a mortgage, especially with where mortgages are at the moment. So you're living in a better property. You're going to make $2 million more in terms of profit. These are just, obviously, guys, these are just very, you know, run-of-the-mill numbers I'm just kind of throwing out. This isn't exact or anything, but this is literally what you can expect. Like, if you have a look at the average growth rates and where you're buying, you know, getting that sort of numbers, they are realistic of what you could expect if you invested over that time window, as opposed to just buying that one primary residence and sitting on it for a 10-year window.
That's a cracker, Sammy. The bull shark has really bitten off that one. Because when you think about it, going back to that security thing, right? Is it security, or is there a false sense of security?
Yeah, definitely.
If you've got that one property.
Well, you're locking yourself in, hey? Like, you're locking yourself into to your future, like at that amount.
Mm.
It's nothing amazing.
We have said this to people many times on the podcast, and I say it all the time on my calls. The biggest issue we find in Australia are people retiring asset rich, but they're cash flow poor.
Yeah, 100%.
And you cannot eat your garage. You can't sell off the back
window. Depends how hungry it depends what it's made of. Gingerbread house, so, I'd have a go at that one.
You would, nothing would be left.
Nothing left, mate. God, we'd never even get built.
So you need that cash flow. You need that cash flow. Mm. So then the question is, right, if we took it back to, say, the first home person who's starting out,
yes,
right? Is it almost to you now? I know you mentioned a few different things, but all things weighing equally,
yep,
it's a no-brainer to be reinvesting first if you're starting out. Is that fair to say? Yeah. So just for those people starting out.
For me, like, the big thing I look at is like realistically, your first property, like, what are you going to be able to buy? Like, most people, like, kind of come 50, 60, even 100,000. Like, are you really going to be able to buy what you really want to be in? And do you want to be kind of, you know, enslaved to that mortgage for the next 10 years, because you're probably not really going to be able to afford anything else. Your serviceability is going to be maxed. You know, I've had, and actually in the coming weeks, we're going to have some clients, some investor stories popping on of this exact scenario. They looked at it and, you know, they're in Sydney, they had 60, 70 grand. And instead they invested in the past they went down and what they're able to build in like a 2-3 year window. And I think it's going to be good to be able to dive into and kind of dissect into that. And actually, I've got a fellow that who was in his 50s. He's going to be jumping on as well in his 50s, and he had to make this decision as well. Now he's 3, going on 4 properties in, and then once he's made the fourth, bought the fourth property, he's going to roll into his primary residence because his missus really, really wants it. But literally, man, like, they've got each of the properties he's bought. We did 2 in Brizzy. We've had a couple, you know, adding a couple in other locations now as well. The 2 we bought in Brizzy doubled for him, you know, in a 2-3 yeah, wow, window. Obviously, we bought extremely well. We bought quite low in the cycle. We did very, very well there. But the growth he's had there is actually giving him this opportunity. And then the other 2 properties we're buying from are cash flow deals. So he's going to get to this point where he's going to be able to sell off his 2 bread and butters that he's made excellent money on, pay these other 2 cash flow deals out, and then by the time he gets to, if that was all he sat on for now and bought his primary residence, he could focus for the next 10 years on paying his primary residence off, down and off, and then by the time he gets there, it's not a huge amount, but if he does nothing else, he'd probably be sitting on $70,000-$80,000 per annum passive just from executing the final amount of deals we got there. You know, sell the 2 bread and butters off, execute the, you know, execute those cash flow deals and just live off. That's as a minimum, you know, and that was going down the route and committing to 2 years of investing before buying the primary residence.
And you know what? It's funny you should say that, because my primary place of residence, I bought I had 5 investment properties before I bought my primary place of residence, looking at that time. And I remember, and if you remember when I did buy it, it was an equity play. It was a really good equity play in the sense that I was getting it at a good price. It was in a growth market. It was in COVID. And obviously I've had a chunk of equity out of that.
Yes.
But it would have been a really bad decision. And I remember you telling me at the time, are you sure about this market? Because if it's not going to do anything, you're going to be stuck and we're not going to be able to continue to borrow.
Yeah.
So I was very fortunate that I was able to.
Yeah.
But it was picking the market. So the answer, I suppose, what I'm the question I'm sort of getting at to people is, at which point should you then look at, if you're investing, which point do you look at to get your primary place of residence? Is it a personal thing? Is it a numbers thing? Is it having a decent amount of properties first? What is it?
Everyone's story and everyone's like tipping point will be different because different people have different goals, right, and ambitions. And some people will be happy with like a $600,000-$800,000 primary residence. And when you're playing in that game, the rent compared to buy price of those two, like compared to mortgage, they can be reasonably close, right? So like I would say minimum, like build out yourself a base portfolio that can tick over in the background and buy that. If you're starting from quite a low point and you want a house of $2-4 million, man, it's at the back end. Like you focus on your portfolio. Don't focus on the primary residence. It's not going to come for a while. Build the portfolio out first. Have some delayed gratification. Even if you go and live somewhere similar, you know, where you want to live and invest in for that. I know there's a lot of markets. You know, you go by the houses in the areas are $3 million, but the rent on it is $1,500 a week. Sounds like a lot of money, but in terms of the cost ratio and the cost difference there, you're probably $50,000-$100,000 in front per annum renting it as opposed to owning it. And if that allows you to then build out a significant portfolio, a very strong portfolio, you know, in 5-10 years, that $3 million property, unless it's used today's dollars for an example, that $3 million property, you might be walking in with $1.5 or $2 million worth of cash as a deposit to be able to buy it, and then just have, you know, $1 million worth of debt on a property worth that, very manageable from that front to be able to own and control as well. Plus you also have a cash flow portfolio built there as well. So there's so many different ways of looking at it. Really comes down to what are they starting with? What incomes are they on? What is that goal home that they're chasing? And I think this is another big one to weigh in and factor into it as well. Are you just going to buy something as a stepping stone? Because you've got to look at the trade costs of, oh, I'm going to buy something now for 700 and then in 5 years I'll buy something for 1.5, but ultimately I want something that's like 3-4 million. Just wait till you can buy what you really want to buy. Invest, build the wealth there with the borrowing capacity going to have, and then buy that when the time's right and you can actually afford it.
And see, those people are saying, oh, we'll get the capital gains tax exemption, but what they're thinking, that's how they would multiply and get into that next deal. But what you're saying, and for the listeners out there, is that you're actually going to get a better result by having more deals under your belt, whether you offload them or you recycle the equity.
Yeah.
The actual velocity of money, trademark Sammy Gordon, the velocity of money is going to allow you to get more deals.
Yes.
Right? So it's important for people not to think that that's the only way to get into that $3 million property.
What you've got to remember as well is if you build the equity and that property grows and doubles and all the rest of it, and let's say it was 750 for really easy figures, it goes from 750 to 1.5. More than likely your $2 million house is also going to go to 4, right? If you're in very similar markets, your growth rate's going to come
that's
through.
A good one.
Yes, you're kind of staying within touching distance, but realistically, you're actually no closer. If it's doubled as well, if it's a very similar market, you're no closer in terms of touching distance. If anything, you might be a little bit further away. It's this whole thing about the rich keep getting richer, because kind of like it kind of gets further and further away from the average person. Whereas if you're kind of building that wealth on the side and you're building it like that and you exactly the same velocity of money, if you can actually scale that quicker and accelerate and beat those growth rates, even though, yes, it's tax deductible debt, all the rest of it, it's you can get so much further building the portfolio in that way than just focusing on that one home there.
You know, it's interesting. A thought came into my head and like obviously we're talking about a $3 million house, right, which is pretty, you know, in terms of percentages of population around the country, we're talking bloody, I don't know, what is it, less than 1%, not even 1%, right? So even if you think on the flip side of that and you thought, okay, well, if I was to live below my means and buy an average house for 800 grand, which is I'm happy with my primary place of residence, right? And you incorporated this kind of strategy, what you're talking about, about investing, theoretically, you'd be able to pay that off in the same time frame. Like we're not trying to scale up to $3 million. But think about what wealth is. It's about low debt. And obviously we want income.
Yep.
So you're actually not going to be, you're going to be closer to actually achieving that financial freedom if you were living below your means. Whereas if you'd have a stretch goal, then obviously you're going to need to be a bit more aggressive in your accumulation. But it just doesn't matter where you're at. The same principle, it works.
It does.
Building out your portfolio.
Yeah, of course.
Whether you want to go $3 million or you want to just consolidate. So my next question, sorry, you had some?
No. What I was going to say is like most people, especially people listening to this, right? And I'm pretty happy to say, and I love the fact that we've got a great audience and they're all very motivated people that are always trying to push harder, right? But a lot of the time, like we're trying to achieve something that we can't achieve quickly. You know, we're all out there trying to build a portfolio. Everyone, a lot of people look at mine and go, wow, man, you got this huge portfolio. So it's like, yeah, man, like it's 33 now. I started building it literally 14 years ago that I started building this portfolio. So like it takes a long time to get to the point where you can get something very significant off the back of it. That's property. It's not a quick turnaround thing. Even though you can make good gains in small windows, it takes time to create serious wealth through property. And I think most people, you know, they're not satisfied with something in the burbs. You know, if something's, you know, not that expensive in the burbs, if they're trying to build something significant here, they're going for something that's like, you know, above average in terms of what they're trying to achieve and what they're chasing. For most people, you can't achieve that. This is the fastest way to achieve it. Actually building it like this, using your primary residence as a stepping stone, it's very hard to like save your way to your dream home or to your dream lifestyle, right? You can't really save your way, you know, pay off a bit of debt, do it this way. But if you're leveraging and you're building those blocks and you're getting up and you're leveling up and building a bigger and bigger portfolio and scaling it, that's what can get you into something above average. Like I always look at myself as a perfect example of this, like very low income, build a massive portfolio of buying the right properties at the right price, right markets, right times, and riding those cycles and building it like that. Like for what I used to make, man, I had no right building what I've built in property, right? But I was able to do it from this, you know, not from income, not trying to save to get in front, all the rest of it, from scaling a portfolio.
You really hit it on the head. And it took me bloody ages to learn this, but I always thought, you know, getting wealthier is earning more. And I was terrible at investing. And I suppose the last few years I've sort of made up for that and really put a big focus on investing. So for those people out there, and you hit it on the head, it's not about how much money you're actually just saving, or even how much you're earning, because inevitably people are spending whatever they earn.
Yeah, that's
it. It is huge. So, and I realize that. So it is the investing portion. You cannot get anywhere if you are not investing. And there's never going to be zero risk.
Beautiful part. Of course. But that's a beautiful part of like releasing equity and building all these different little income streams and all the rest of it through it. It's like, you can scale it and you build it, and you keep it all. It's all about, it's like in an ecosystem, right? It's like your portfolio is like its own ecosystem. You keep building it. And when you start, you chip in to get it really going and building. But then once it's that snowball effect that we always talk about, once it snowballs and it takes off, you pretty well don't need to put anything in there. It just kind of scales itself and keeps building from there. That's a big game changer thing, because it will take care of itself and it will go to another level. But when, exactly like you said, man, it's a great point. When people make more money, 9 times out of 10, they spend more. Oh man, I'm making 250 now. I'm gonna go buy myself something hectic. You know, yeah, gonna go upgrade this. Oh yeah, let's go on a trip. Let's go
holidays. Yeah,
and it's all good. Reward yourself. You know, that's great. It's all good. But like, realistically, this is what can take you. And this is like, that's what I love about this, because it's almost on the side. It's like everyone talks about a side hustle and the rest of it. There is no better side hustle than leveraging property and deposits and everything and building this thing on the side, because you get $1 million in property. You know, and that could be 2-3 properties. You build that, and you can do that quite quickly, 12-18 months off a single deposit. You build that, and then that thing has 10% growth, you know, as an average rate. You're making 100 grand a year. You have a great run, you have a 20%, you have 20% growth in a market or a couple of markets in a year. It's made 200,000 tax-free. Pull that out, roll in some more deals. You know what I mean? And then you go through another one. It's just huge. It just multiplies and builds and again, compounding effect. That's a body we need to cover soon, because that 100% compounding effect and the way it goes. Then it is unmatched, it's untouchable. Is it Warren Buffett, ready? Right? Is it eighth wonder of the world? Mate, was Warren 100%. Buffett one of his great sayings? 100%. Eighth wonder of the world is compounding interest.
I've got, because I know it's your birthday and I've gone easy on you, but I've got a cracker to finish off with. Right, let's finish. Sammy. So for the people that are out there that have bought their primary place of residence,
yes.
At which point do you think about selling it, having the cojones, the big, you know, to sell them and go back into investing? Which would you do it? And at which point should you consider it?
Okay. There's a couple of things to consider here. If you're in your dream market, that like, let's say you're at a 1.5 mil market or something, and your dream market's double that. Okay. But in the same area. If you hold that property and you can rent it for a very similar money to go and rent somewhere else, and that's going to increase your serviceability to allow you to continue investing, I would do that. Because if you do that, you're keeping that property that's keeping you arm's length, you know, that touching distance to the sort of property that you really want.
Okay, so you're holding onto it and renting.
Yeah. That's what I did. So I held on to that asset and I rented it, and that's why I went and rented somewhere else that I really wanted to live that I couldn't could afford to buy, but I knew it would kill my borrowing capacity again. That is always a desired result. You know, if you can hang on to it and go invest, you know, go invest somewhere else, go rent where you want to live, even if it is in that same area, if it gives you that serviceability back, then that's perfect. The only time you would look to sell is if, like, you knew that market wasn't going to do anything for 10 years and you were just holding it for the sake of holding it and you had a lot of capital tied up in it and you couldn't access the debt, but you want to invest. You know what I mean? Like, there's all these things here that are, like, cumulatively making a decision. We should probably look at selling this thing.
That's the false sense of security, right?
And if it's holding you back. So, like, if you're going to hold it, it's not going to do anything for 10 years. And you're literally just, like, you're going to be spinning wheels because you also can't invest. That is a decision in my mind. I would, as you say, man, have big enough cojones to cut that thing off and move forward and kind of keep investing. So it always comes down to that, man. That always comes back though to the velocity of money. You know, if that is really what you're chasing and you want to build that portfolio and that primary residence is holding you back, that's what you need to look at.
Dude, I tell you, we've definitely nailed this topic. It's funny because we were saying we'll wrap this up in 20 minutes, 25 minutes. I think we're tipping over, nearly 50 minutes or something. But anyway, it was actually quite interesting. I hope everyone listening out there took something out of it. Regardless of where you are in your journey, I hope you took something out of it. And if you did, and you got any comments on that, I'd love to hear from you. Make sure you write in.
Yeah,
because of course they're going to be writing in to say happy birthday because we are releasing this today, folks.
This is going out to
the market. If this doesn't get the worm out, I tell you what, because if you've been following us, how many did we say? How many subscribers?
The worm. There is going to be an update on the worm, guys. Next potty, I have an update for you at the start of the potty on the worm. It is getting close. The windmill is a little bit further.
So if people have no idea what we're talking about, it's basically Sammy said, tune in next step. You'll find out all about it. But mate, I think we nailed today's topic. It's an absolute cracker and people ask us all the time. So hopefully we delivered some value for everyone out there.
If there's anything anyone stumped on with it as well, or anything that you think we missed, please write in. We've got the Q&As coming up. We're going to be doing the Q&As once a month. If there's anything we missed from today's section that you'd like covered, guys, write in any extra questions on the PPR versus rent vesting, and we'll look to cover off in that next session. If I can get my words right, I'm getting a bit old for this, mate.
You've already been on the Sam Bookers this morning, haven't you? It's your birthday,
mate. Fireballs. I've smacked half a dozen of fireball shots. I'm struggling. But look, guys. Hey. Jimmy, well, mate,
quickly, I just want to know what you're doing for your birthday because the listeners want to know anything special today for the big day.
No, I'm just working. Morgs, my partner Morgs, she's obviously in the business as well. She took me down. We headed down to Byron for the weekend, so we've already had a little bit of a celebration.
Oh, nice.
I'm in Sydney, mate, tomorrow for the week, and then no big party celebrations tonight, mate.
Mate, but hopefully you have a chance to have a celebration. Have a couple of shardies.
Sam Bookers for you and a couple of fireballs for me. All right.
Okay.
But guys, Jimmy, mate, as always, thank you for jumping on, buddy. It was a good topic, mate. I know you've been wanting to dissect this one for quite a while. And listeners, thank you very much. Always appreciate you tuning in. As always, guys, if you took some value out of this app, I would really appreciate it. And it really helps us grow the brand and grow the podcast and share the love and the insights. If you took value out of it, if you could please send it on to someone else you think would take value out of it, you may have, you know, a sibling or a parent or something, a son, a child that might be considering this and really tossing up that primary residence versus rent vesting strategy. Maybe you'd never heard about it before and you want to throw it towards them as a bit of a learning piece as well. So anyone you think could take value out of this, guys, we would super appreciate you flicking it on and passing on the love in that regard. If you haven't left us a 5-star review yet and you're enjoying the show, please jump onto your favorite platform that you're listening to this on. Give us a review. We bloody love you for it. And guys, other than that, please send in more questions. We got more Q&As coming. Q&A last week went off. More and more people asking for more of it. They want more questions answered. So if you've got more things you want to cover, guys, please send them in. We'd love to cover off everything you guys have got on your property-related questions. The questions keep coming in about Jimmy's age. Guys, I need you to send in the answers. That's the one that I need the answers on. That is the question. Until someone guesses it, we don't get it. Jimmy, I'm going to call out today. We did have, is it 40? Bumper. Big Brenton. That was his guess. Is it 40?
40. Nah, already in the noughties.
Ooh, so there we go. Okay, not 40, Brenton. Thanks for the guest, mate. Until next time. But yeah, guys, thanks again for listening to another episode of the Scouting Australia podcast. We'll be back next week. Send in your reviews, send in your questions. Jimmy, thank you once again, mate. Until next time, guys, signing off.
Happy birthday, Sammy.
Thanks, brother.